I'm Julie Wilkes, and I'm at Manchester. It's a bit faint on there. Sue Spear, for those of you who know her, is my supervisor. And we're just working into the papers, which is the kind of end of my PhD. And basically, this is what I'm going to talk about today. This is one of the first papers that'll actually come out of the PhD. At Manchester, they make us... they make us write papers rather than produce theses. We're not allowed to produce a thesis anymore. It's all gone. So the general thesis that this paper sits inside is about kinship care and identity. First thing, I guess, is I'm a kinship carer. Apologies to those of you who heard all this before, but those who haven't, I'm a kinship carer because I have two grandchildren. Their father died when one was four and one was six, and their mother is long-term mentally ill. So at that age, we took them on full-time, and that was 13 years ago. And we basically act as their parents. That's it. We are their parents, to all intents and purposes. So what kinship carers do, there are an awful lot of us across the UK. There's about, I mean, it's really hard. There are no proper statistics, and it's done through census data. That's the only way of finding out how many of us there are. It's reckoned to be across the UK between 200,000 and 300,000 children being looked after permanently by relatives who are not their birth parents. The key thing to say is that this is not a lifestyle choice. Some people think it's a kind of cuddly, lovely thing that grandparents do. This is basically a matter of necessity, otherwise the kids would be in care. And the main reason that kinship care happens is substance misuse, alcohol misuse, mental health problems, suicide, etc., etc. So it's a difficult world to enter in many ways. And the parent pretty much, and will be in all the instances I'm going to show you, is pretty much still somewhere on the scene, although where the scene is can be very variable. So what this position in a family does is it gives rise to all sorts of really interesting conundrums about your identity. Because you're not a parent, you're not their parent, you are no longer their grandparent, you cannot act as a grandparent in this role, and virtually nobody that you meet understands what you're doing. And you have to do a lot of explaining, and legally speaking, there's a, I'm not going to go into that because that just takes the rest of the half hour, but there's a whole range of different ways that kinship carers legally do this stuff. And an awful lot have no legal status whatsoever. So they have that to deal with too. So things like border controls and going to the dentist and all that. I'll tell a little anecdote, because I tell this anecdote to the people that I go and record. I once took my granddaughter to the jewellery shop. It was her 16th birthday and she wanted her ears pierced. And so... the woman, we chose the earrings, we got all the friends there, a little group of little girls, and I go up and we say, we'd like these, please, and the woman says, and turns to me, she says, are you mum? Well, I can't say I am. That would be the easy way out, because if you say that, then you're, you know. But Charlotte stood next to me, so she knows I'm not mum, I can't say I'm her mother. Well, do you have any paperwork? So we have to drive 10 miles back home to pick up the paperwork, to bring it back to the earring shop to get the ears pierced. You know, that's just life for kinship carers. But so it does create some identity issues and it creates interesting conversations about all of that. So it upsets normative expectations. So how do, my thesis questions, how do kinship carers go about managing this identity? How do they do it? So there's a network across the UK of self-help support groups. And I went and visited 10 of these groups and I recorded an ordinary meeting of a support group. So I was just kind of there and I took a video. They were very kind. So when I got the data, transcribed it, trawled through it, with some help, obviously, I discovered that most of this data is complaint sequences. It's troubles telling. I mean, it's a kind of obvious thing that when you go to a support group, you're not going to talk about how wonderful your life is, because that isn't kind of supportive. What you're going to do is you're going to talk about trouble, and you're going to tell stories about problems. So it's a great activity, complaining in support groups. What I then wanted to do, once I'd isolated 108 complaint sequences, all of which are about absent third parties, I thought, well, you know, how am I going to, how do I break these down? What are the patterns here? First pattern I found was that almost half of the complaints were about birth parents. And when I looked at the complaints about birth parents, I noticed that there was a very high proportion of references to time as a central feature in those complaints about birth parents. Now, I'm really very much indebted to the appearance of the paper in 2017 by Raymond and White, which immediately put me into the frame of thinking, how am I going to analyse these time references? Time references, first of all, are obviously great resources for complaining, because complaints are about lack of coordination, lack of cooperation, lack of getting on together in some way. And you only have to think about, you know, your own life, like you said you were going to do the hoovering. I am going to do the hoovering. Now, is there a time reference in that exchange? Time is of the essence when human agreement is needed. Because if time slips, agreement slips. But it may not be directly referenced. And this is the curious thing about time reference. And the more I've looked at time reference, the more curious it gets. Okay, these time references in my data are not about time. Point one. They are not about people being late. They are not about people failing to coordinate. They may be something to do with people failing to cooperate, but they're not about people's use of time. These time references are doing something else, and that is the really curious thing. So, what are they doing? They are formulations, and this is from Raymond and White, used by speakers to bring about a mutual orientation to a time point. But they may not necessarily be talking only about or just about time. One of the things that Raymond and White point out in their typology of time reference is, well, let's go back a little bit. I mean, there's very little CA work actually on time reference. The seminal papers are, there's a mention by Pomerantz, there's an excellent paper by Button, which begins to define members' time, and then there's the Raymond and White papers. Other than those, there's very little. What those papers tend to do is talk about taxonomies. They tend to try to divide time reference into absolute ones, like was it Wednesday or Thursday, which are not event relative in that way, or they talk about relational reference, which is about time as a kind of cultural resource that's treated as shared among members, which then starts to constitute the membership of a group that recognises that kind of time. Now, you could say that stuff like Thanksgiving is a cultural time reference, so is Christmas, but the literature tends to treat those references as absolute. What I'm starting to find in my work is that those taxonomies don't work, and they don't get us where we need to be, because any absolute time referent is going to be used in a relational way. So people tend, we'll look at some of the data and see how we're doing. I wanted to see what time references were doing in these complaints. So, let's start with the first slide.
My son just goes around telling everybody I'm a child snatcher, but he's the perfect dad. Yeah. With his kids more than anything else, he'd do anything for them, but he forgets their birthdays and forgets Christmas. Don't bother coming to see them.
I'll play that again.
My son just goes around telling everybody I'm a child snatcher, but he's the perfect dad. Yeah. Loves his kids more than anything else, and he'd do anything for them, but he forgets their birthdays and forgets Christmas. Don't bother coming to see them.
Okay. So this is a complaint from a kinship carer about an absent third party who is the birth parent of her child. My son goes around telling everybody I'm a child snatcher and he's the perfect dad. So we've got a nice script formulation going in the first part, where what he's doing is being built as habitual, as typical. This is what he says, this is the kind of thing he goes around saying. But the point here, he forgets their birthdays and forgets Christmas. This is not an accusation about timekeeping. This doesn't mean he's late. It doesn't mean he doesn't know that the 25th of December is Christmas Day. It doesn't mean he doesn't know when the child's birthday is. This is not being used in an absolute sense. This is being used in an event relative sense. So what's the event that's relative to this time referent? And this is where we began to get this sense that we know this, but how do we know this? And how do the members know this? And we know this because here, what's being used is a kind of a device, which I've begun to call child's time. And it's basically a basket of things or time references that fit together, like birthdays, Christmas, early years, regularity, expectations, surprises, etc. And what's going on is that members are mutually recognising and treating this as a common domain that they know and understand. It's shared epistemic territory, and it's used to construct parental attributes and behaviours. So what's expectable of parents at these times? It's not spelled out. It is treated as scripted by members. So in all the references that I have in my data, this is the kind of mechanism that's going on. Now, so the accusation is event relative. He has failed to do something that marks these occasions. So this is a jointly framed event relative referent. An observance or failure to observe such a referent is category relative. And the category it's relative to is good parenting. And failure to observe it is bad parenting. So we have a kind of a categorical move going on. Let's do the next one. Oh, there we are.
Problems about contact, and it's like the birth parents are telling us what they want and not what's in the interest of the child. You see, it's like my son, he hasn't seen his children for over 2 years now. He hasn't had proper contact. And as soon as he found out that I'd beat the car for this SGO to phone me up and demanded to see the kids at that weekend, and I went, I can't do that until I've actually got the court paper and we sit down.
There are a number of time reference here. I'm going to play it again so you can just...
...the problems about contact, and it's like the birth parents are telling us what they want and not what's in the interest of the child. You see, it's like my son, he hasn't seen his children for what, over two years now. He hadn't had proper contact. And as soon as he found out that I'd beat the call for this SGO to phone me up and demanded to see the kids at that weekend, and I went, I can't do that until I've actually got the court paper and we sit down.
Okay. What's going on here is, again, a reference to Charles Time. How that's being built is, in line 9, she's actively shaping the group member's judgment of the length of the birth father's absence. So she starts by struggling to recall how long it was. And what's going on there is over 2 years now. The length of the duration acts as an anchor reference point for the recipient's calculation. They calculate that themselves. And they calculate what that means in this context. It sets out the passage of time against which news of his sudden demand to see the children can be assessed. So it's creating a time frame against which that demand is assessed. What it's also doing, the duration over 2 years now provides an anchoring background which is a span of lack of contact, against which to interpret the timing of his reported discovery as soon as he found out. As soon as he found out is another referent. So you have two spans working together to enable a judgment as to what this actually means, what it signifies about the birth parents' motivation. This is a motivational account where the 2 year absence is judged in one particular way because of Charles Time. You just have to know that a 2 year absence is going to be problematic for a child. You also have to know that a sudden appearance of a parent after a 2 year absence is going to need managing. She's not spelling that out. Everybody's orienting to this. They know that this is about child's time. This is about how parents manage time with children and the importance of childhood time and what time means in childhood, which is quite a significant matter. So what's going on here is she's saying that it's at the point that he picks up that there's a new court order that he rings and demands to see them that weekend. So it's about change of status. And she's referencing the change. What the group members will know, you may not be familiar with, is that if you get a special guardianship order, suddenly the relationship with the state vanishes and you become solely accountable for what's going on. So you have to then manage those relationships. Up until that point, the state's been there managing those relationships. So his phone call is being attributed to the change in legal status, not to the desire to see the children. And the members in the group are all absolutely aware of that. It's really hard to argue this in CA terms without the concept of child's time, which is why I've kind of invented it, because it's needed in order to make sense of how these people are making sense of what they're doing. Let me just move on. So, and the last time referent, until. So what Rita does at the last point is she stalls for time. She puts a time barrier in. I'm not going to see you until I've had time to sit down and get the court papers. So she pushes back against the demand. So there's a general treatment of time as scripted. So birth parents' use of time and timing is built as unwelcome, over-entitled, insensitive, and Rita stalling for time because she's demonstrating what sensible parents do in relation to child's time. So her enactment of stalling is part of her identity construction. Final, quick.
thing. She does not want it. Set fire to it. That's all she keeps telling me. Set fire to it. I don't want it. But this, you know, the no contact is now birth mum's choice. We've been in a bit of court battle, and it's now over and done with. She told the judge that she didn't want anything to do with the child, whether it be in direct or direct contact. No more. There's my number. When she's 18, let her get in touch with me. And Hope's like, she don't want to see me now, I'm not seeing her at 18. Yeah. 10-year-old, she's quite a savvy young girl.
Yeah.
As with the previous slide, the carer is juxtaposing two time references to create a motivational account. So this time, the time reference is the full duration of the legal order, which has far heavier moral consequences than the previous slide. The timeline here is quite complex in this short clip. It's constructed from several time references. There's the bitter court battle, which is now over, so the now is positioned. Then there is the birth mother's announcement at the court hearing of the duration of time for which she will not see the child. And again, the listeners have to calculate what that is based on the information that they're given. So she doesn't want to see the child until the child is 18. And what we get at the bottom is 10-year-old, yeah, quite a savvy young girl. That's 8 years. So the parent is asking not to see the child for 8 years until she's 18. And she's saying, there's my phone number. Tell her to ring me when she's 18. As a consequence of the bitter court battle. The now is significant as a time reference in that it divides the past, which is when the parent did want to see the child, from now, when she doesn't. And the occasioning of that is the court hearing. So again, the inference from the time references is, because of the timing of this, we know that the motivation is to do with the legal status rather than the relationship with the child. So it's all built, all of it is built through time references. And the child, she don't want to see me now, I'm not seeing her when I'm 18. Again, you have the now, the 18, you've got a passage of time between the two. And of course the kinship carer uses the child's direct reported speech as a way of affiliating with the child rather than judging directly herself. So it's a presentational matter that she's with the child on this. Okay, so what I hope I've shown you is there are two distinctive ways that carers are using time reference as a resource in building complaints. One is the whole notion of child's time. I accept that this is going to be controversial, but I do think that this is a device that we have evidence of. And the other, and I can't believe there's no other CA work on this, but if anyone can find it and let me know, please do, that when you put two time references together and you hook them together, they tell a motivational account. I can't find that. If anyone can find that somewhere else, because I can't believe that no one has picked that up in the last 40 odd years. But what I keep seeing is these two time reference creating motivation. And yeah, so that's what we've done so far. Thank you.
Super. Thank you, Julie. Time for a couple of questions. Marina at the back.
Hi. Well, thank you for that. It was really lovely. I was interested in the use of direct speech. And in the first example, the time reference comes in a very, very subtle shift from the animation of a voice of the complainable person. And then the time reference is produced by in a voice that can be associated, perhaps, by the one who's doing the talking at the moment. But this is not the case, perhaps, with the last one. I don't know, perhaps it might help your case to see when these time references, whose voice is. Yeah.
I've done quite a lot of work on the direct speech in the complaints. As you can imagine, there's lots of it. There's hypothetical there's directly quoted, there's impossible. You know, I mean, there's a whole range of the ways that these complaints are built around purported reported speech. What's driving me potty at the moment is my supervisor keeps having a go, because like, I keep slipping into, and they said this. No, they didn't. Someone reported that they said this. This is all reported, the whole thing. None of this need have happened. Who knows? I don't know.
Andrew.
Just very quickly, is it only specifically two time references, or have you got any more than two?
Ooh, what a lovely question. I haven't seen...
Because when I was writing my notes, I wrote multiple time references, but then I've realised that you've only actually said two.
Do you mean in relation to the motivation?
Yeah. Anyway, okay, I'll just leave it there for you.
I'm going to look.
Okay.
I'm going to look.
I hadn't really thought about it, but but in our NHS complaints data where we've looked at time, we have a similar phenomenon with time reference points being juxtaposed.
Yeah.
It's very similar kind of thing.
Well, it must be universal,
yeah.
It's just we haven't
looked
at it.
Wait a minute, I can see Dr. Stevenson looking at me intelligently. No? Just in generally do. Okay. We go back to Catherine.
I was interested that you kind of think child's time might be controversial, because it seems to me that it's a kind of natural progression of Button's members' time to think that members aren't always members of big society, members are members of something.
Yeah.
And, you know, what you've clearly got here is kind of orientation to family, albeit a non-traditional family, but orientation to family, members of family, members' time is members of family. It doesn't seem to be...
I guess my concern would be, mirroring back, is it begins to sound like one of those slippery sociological concepts that kind of start to take over, and, you know, that isn't...
But if you can demonstrate orientation to the family device, then it makes sense that members are, if they're orienting to the device, then any kind of members' references are going to be potentially with reference to that device.
Thank you.
Well,
that's great.
I would say.
I'm with you.
Okay, one last question or observation. Yes.
Many think about the broad discourse around child's time in the court system and how there's so much that's oriented to. Is this within the timescales that are suitable for this child's needs? That was one comment.
Yeah.
I was really interested in this idea of shared epistemic territory. There was so much that was shared around the way the court process works, what a bit of court battle is, and I thought that was a really interesting area, slightly different, but an interesting area to explore.
I mean, the PLO, for those of us that know it, is an absolute nightmare. That's the 6 month limit on once you've started proceedings, you have to finish proceedings in that time. And what it does, particularly for kinship carers, is it tends to exclude us from consideration, and it puts a lot of pressure onto fostering and adoption because it has to go through so fast. A government were thinking that they didn't want children waiting around, but actually there is such a thing as members' time. People need the time to make things work the way that it needs to work, and that's a natural process. It can't be governed by laws. It's unfortunate.
Okay, we'll stop there. Thanks very much.